first ever episode of Visible Illnesses, the podcast that explores hidden health issues that don't show up in medical tests, but which can be debilitating and life-changing for a huge number of patients and the people around them. My name's Alex Ward-Booth, and I wanted to do this podcast based on my own healthcare experience, share some of the things that I found useful, often things that were hiding in plain sight right in front of me. The guest for our first episode is actually going to be my co-host for the podcast going forward, Dr. Stephen Ward-Booth. Stephen, or Steve as I know him, is a GP with nearly 30 years clinical experience and a passion for seeing the whole patient. Since moving from hospital medicine to general practice back in 2002, Steve's curiosity and hands-on work with real people and academics alike have helped him to develop what I think is a really fascinating perspective and understanding of what can make people ill and how they can get better. In today's episode, Steve is going to talk about the concept of functional illness, which will really underpin the whole series. He'll share the medical perspective around this and the invisible illnesses that sit behind it and share his own experiences working with patients. In future episodes, we'll hear more patient stories, including my own, to bring these medical facts to life and hear from other experts on relevant topics around this area. Now, before we go into today's episode, it's important to share a disclaimer. While Stephen is a practicing GP, the purpose of this podcast is to give you information only. He's not assessed you and any symptoms you may have, so the information he shares can never be really specific to you and your situation. The information is not a substitute for medical assessment or guidance from your own doctor. If you have any concerns about your health, we really recommend you speak first to your own GP. With that in mind though, let's move on to our first interview and hear more from Steve himself. Hey there, Steve, and welcome to the show, our first episode of Invisible Illnesses. So thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, hi Alex. Yeah, very exciting. Yeah.
You could sound a little bit excited, Steve.
I'm genuinely excited, Alex. Genuinely
excited. Okay, good, good, good. That's what I like. That's what I like. No, good. Well, listen, I think kind of in terms of kicking us off on this, when we talk about invisible illnesses, I think what we're talking about from a medical terminology is a term called functional illness, which we've talked about a lot, but I'm conscious people listening might not know what that term means or even have heard it before. So perhaps we start there. Could you tell us what kind of functional illness is?
Yeah, sure. So it's not a perfect term at all, and you'll find different doctors use slightly different language and different patients do. And there isn't a perfect definition of what we're talking about. But I think from a pragmatic point of view, what I think is easy to understand both sides of the consulting desk, if you like, doctors and patients, is that we're dealing with a situation where someone has real physical symptoms caused by real disturbances in bodily functioning, but blood tests, scans, and generally speaking, examination findings are unhelpful. They don't show anything specific. And to further help with kind of identification of this, terms that people might be familiar with would be things like irritable bowel syndrome or fibromyalgia syndrome, or there's a lot from every little different department, and we'll come on to those.
And does it, are you just going to say in every department? So by that, do you mean, you know, it can be in any part of the body? So it's not sort of specifically in one particular part of your body?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you, so anatomically, you know, it can be different parts of the body, but also if you think about physiological symptoms. So for example, functional neurological disorders is a term that I think people are increasingly aware of. That would be in the neurology department of the hospital. And those would be symptoms that we would kind of think of as related to our nervous system. So they might include things like numbness or tingling, sensory symptoms, changes in power, motor symptoms, those be called, what we call, so even things that resemble epileptic seizures. They're not epileptic, but they involve a collapse and apparent loss of consciousness. So that would be an example of a system. But then we could go anatomically as well. Like I said, irritable bowel syndrome would give you gut and abdominal symptoms, chronic pelvic pain syndromes, the pelvis.
So you know, just with some of the examples you gave there, I mean, the thing to remember there is these can be really serious things. You know, it can feel really serious and really scary for the individual, But at the same time, you can find that a scan or a blood test will not show anything. So that's a really important thing to remember here, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, such an important point. I mean, there is some, you know, there's data that suggests that often the degree of debility or severity of symptoms is frequently much more severe in the functional disorder than perhaps the traditional biomedical equivalent, if you like. And you know, drawing equivalence is perhaps slightly artificial, but let's say, for example, that we, you know, many patients with irritable bowel syndrome will have more loose stools per day than most patients with inflammatory bowel disease during a flare-up. Mm-hmm. So by inflammatory bowel disease, I mean things like Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, which are medically diagnosable conditions. Endoscopies show the bowel to be inflamed or ulcerated. Blood results will often be abnormal, etc., etc. And yet, it, by certain measures of symptom severity and debility from them, irritable bowel syndrome will often be more severe. Similarly, with fibromyalgia and the pain that people feel in their muscles and joints, often much, much more disabled than patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Again, rheumatoid being a serious inflammatory disease with abnormal blood tests, abnormal examination findings, x-rays and things like that.
Okay. And that seems like a really important point, actually, then, for us, is that, you know, is it a fact that, Because that's a you know, certainly when you talk about inflammatory bowel disease and irritable bowel disease, that's something that's very close to home for me. So I have ulcerative colitis, but I also have had, you know, periods of irritable bowel syndrome, so IBS as well, which generally is kind of, as you say, what happens for me is that will come at times of stress. It will be when I'm under pressure, and it will be other things may go along with that as well. So it may be kind of problems with the gut, but also kind of headaches or joint pain. Is that potentially a factor here, that other things are happening at the same time when it's a functional illness?
Yeah, so it's no coincidence that you have irritable bowel syndrome and inflammatory bowel disease. So we know that I think it's about half of people with inflammatory bowel disease also have coexistent IBS at certain points in their lives. And that's way higher than the general prevalence of irritable bowel syndrome in the population, which is something like sort of 12-13%, something like that. Similarly, if we look at something like dysfunctional breathing, or what are called breathing pattern disorders, which might include hyperventilation, but there are other patterns as well, they're way more common in people who have asthma, particularly people who have severe asthma, than they are in the general population. And you mentioned stress as a trigger for your IBS. Stress can be a very important driver in lots of these illnesses. It's not the only factor at all, but it can be a very important factor. And we will talk about this in much more detail later. But it's, you know, if you've had a serious disease, inflammatory disease, let's say ulcerative colitis or asthma, which you have maybe had to go into hospital for. In ulcerative colitis, you might end up having emergency surgery and having your entire large bowel removed. You know, in asthma, you might end up in intensive care. These are serious and scary events. And so the next time the patient with inflammatory bowel disease gets a little bit of diarrhea or some tummy pain, the significance of that symptom, or the next time a patient with asthma feels their chest feels a bit funny, the significance of that symptom will be greatly different to someone who didn't have inflammatory bowel disease or asthma. And quite logically, at a conscious level, that would be more concerning. But most importantly, at a subconscious level, where we lay down our memories that influence our physiological responses, those alter. So our central nervous system adapts to our environment to make us better prepared for dangerous situations. That's part of our primal mammalian programming. And if in your particular case, one of those danger signals from the past has been gut symptoms, then your animal brain is going to be much more tuned to those. So yes, it isn't. There's no coincidence that often the pattern of functional symptoms might, they will often echo or reflect past experiences, but if those past experiences happen to be medical ones, in that you have another illness or disease, then there's that link there directly.
Okay, yeah, that's really interesting. That's really, I mean, it's a fascinating area. I mean, I think one of the things that might be helpful for the listeners as well is to understand your story of how you got into this area. You know, what kind of, can you tell us kind of how you kind of stumbled upon this stuff and kind of when you first kind of found out about it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, very sort of slowly and organically. Maybe I'm a slow learner, I guess. But I've got no formal, post medical degree qualification in this stuff. I have formal postgraduate qualification as a GP, which is how I practice. But it was something that I noticed, and a lot of it's sort of with hindsight, really. So I often find myself a little bit baffled as a junior doctor in hospital, noticing that people's symptom severity didn't always map very well to people's blood results or x-rays or scan results. And this sort of, I perhaps didn't pay a huge amount of conscious direct attention to it, but this sort of, again, gradually built up with time. And then I spent some time working alongside my GP job in a specialist gastroenterology clinic, and the functional gut disorders are very, very common, and it became increasingly clear how many patients were going through a process of fruitless investigation, and yet these patients were really suffering, and they had very real symptoms, and what I also found was that in that very medicalized or biomedicalized world of a hospital outpatient clinic, there wasn't that much acknowledgement that there were this big chunk of patients for whom this medicalized process of scanning and x-raying and blood testing and then giving medications and wasn't really helping them. It wasn't really explaining their illness very well, and it wasn't helping them get better.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that? Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I think it's complicated. I think at the root of this, we have had in the past, and I think still to some degree, the medical school education doesn't address this well enough, and it certainly didn't. My recollection was that irritable bowel syndrome would be something of a footnote at the end of the gastroenterology chapter. And there would be pages on Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis and even rarer gut disorders, and irritable bowel syndrome would be this thing that was a bit of an add-on at the end, and I think you'd see the same in the neurology chapter and etc. And I think that part of it relates to the complexity of these illnesses, which we'll go on to talk about a lot more. If you look at the great detail of something like asthma or inflammatory bowel disease, we still don't completely understand every element of that. We don't completely understand why some people get ulcerative colitis and others don't. We have some theories, but we don't have a complete understanding. But it's quite easy to understand that someone's bowel looks inflamed. And if you administer drugs which reduce inflammation, for example, steroids, then that inflammation gets better. Or even simpler, if someone's colon is very, very inflamed to a life-threatening degree, if you operate on them and remove their colon, then things will get better. So that's quite simple, okay? And I'm not pretending that there aren't lots of complexities in the detail of these illnesses, but at some level, that's quite simple. And we therefore have medical interventions. So it sat with a very traditional medical model of doing stuff to patients, giving them drugs, doing operations, and finding abnormal test results to make a diagnosis. That fits very well with existing kind of medical understanding and gives us a route forward. Now, if we say that a lot of these functional disorders are highly complicated and the drivers for them are not exactly the same in two different people, so stress may be important, but it might be past trauma from childhood. It might be current stress of a current situation. It might be less about stress and more, or it might be that the person doesn't feel particularly anxious, but are working in a very driven way. They might enjoy that work, but they might be working it in an intensive way, and their balance between their work life and other elements of their life might not be quite right. In gut symptoms, it might relate to diet to some degree, as our gut responds differently to different foods. Everybody's does, but those changes become heightened or exaggerated in irritable bowel syndrome. So because you've got this complexity, then I think it's to some extent ended up in the too difficult to treat, too difficult to understand draw for lots of doctors and for medical education. So I think that's part of it. And then, of course, you've got the complexity where you mentioned earlier, Alex, that when you see flares of irritable bowel syndrome, you see non-gut symptoms with it. Headaches, I think, maybe tiredness, was the other thing you said. And of course, that's very true with lots of functional disorders. So most people who have a more severe functional disorder like fibromyalgia will also have irritable bowel syndrome. And so you start to see that the hospital model of different specialties only ever picks up part of the picture some of the time.
Yeah. I mean, it almost sounds like a really simplistic way of saying that is if you're in a specialist department, you've basically someone's given you a hammer, so you're just looking for nails everywhere. But actually, what you might find with some of these patients is yes, that's there, but then there's a screw and a something else and something you've never even seen before, and so you're almost that specialization may make it difficult to see something that which is. You know, covering a lot of different symptoms.
Absolutely. Don't get me. So there's a couple of points here. So first, don't get me wrong. Specialization is really important. It has huge value. You know, if I'm going to have a hip replacement, I don't want a general surgeon who does a few hips, some thyroids and some guts to do it, you know, as happened in the sort of 1800s. I want a guy who is not just a specialist orthopedic surgeon, but I want the orthopedic surgeon who does only hips. You know, you know, and the same's true of my thyroid specialist or my diabetologist. Mm. So there's huge advantages to that. But one of the trade-offs is that you have a difficulty if you're working in a gut clinic, having that kind of oversight to deal with perhaps the neurological type symptoms that patient's got or whatever else. The other thing I think that's slightly more than that, because it's not just about looking for nails with your hammer as a solution. One of the very important things that our specialists do, and even our generalists, if we think about an A&E department, is a lot of the time what we want from our doctors is to rule out dangerous disease. Okay, and you notice I use the word dangerous, not serious, and maybe it's a bit arbitrary, but what we'll see a lot of the time in A&E is people will go in with, let's say, chest pain. That's a really important symptom to go to A&E with. But there will be a very standard set of blood tests, ECG and a chest x-ray, which will rule out life-threatening heart disease and lung disease. And the patient will then be sent home. But the patient will still have chest pain. And that happens a huge amount of the time. But we still, you know, that's something very, very useful. But that person still needs an understanding of what's causing their chest pain. And if it's a chronic problem that's ongoing and might be impacting on their functioning, they need some solutions for it. But that's not necessarily forthcoming from a very standard kind of biomedical model. And it was these frustrations and seeing the huge volume of patients with these experiences, which I guess gradually pushed me to take a greater interest, read more, and start approaching the management in a different way.
Yeah, and so that was kind of, you know, I'm truncating your entire career into very simple bits here, but you kind of started off in hospital and then kind of went into kind of general practice where you could see more of that kind of broader picture, I guess, of people.
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of when you got there of, you know, what this, when you could see that full story playing out of that kind of, where that sort of functional illness is coming in for one individual, but potentially not for another. Is there an example you can give to kind of bring to life what that looks like?
So firstly, I've been a GP for, I think, 21, 22 years, something like that. So, you know, I came out of hospital a long time ago. One of the first things I remember as training as a GP outside hospital was how often I was surprised by patients not having abnormal blood results or scans. I would see patients with pretty dramatic symptoms, including, you know, this one guy sticks in my mind with gut symptoms and huge amounts of weight loss, and I was sure he was going to turn out to have bowel cancer. And he didn't. And it was a kind of turning point moment where I realized, look, the background prevalence of these biomedical structural diseases is much lower in the real world of the general population than it is in hospitals where that stuff is concentrated. So that was the first thing. And then there was another moment I think which stuck in my mind a little bit about do you know, Alex, would you be able to answer the question, what's the difference between illness and disease?
No, are they not the same thing? I don't know.
There's an important difference, and to be honest, that goes sort of to the heart of what general practice is all about, really. But so let me give you this is an example from very, very many years ago, and I saw two patients and relatively close together, which is why it stuck in my mind, and they were both presenting, in a biomedical sense, with the same thing. They had a groin hernia, an inguinal hernia, which are relatively common condition, certainly common in a surgical department in a hospital, perhaps less so in the general population, but relatively common. As people know what that is, it's where you get a gap between muscles, abdominal muscles in the groin, and the abdominal contents poke through that, and that might include some fat or it might include a bit of bowel, and it produces a lump in the groin, which is a bit uncomfortable, but varying degrees of discomfort really, and some people have very little pain with them at all. First patient I saw was a fairly recently retired, very fit and well guy, pretty well to do. I think he'd moved to my locality to get a boat, and he was doing up his boat and enjoying his retirement. And it was a very transactional kind of consultation. He knew what he had. I got this hernia, I'd like to get it fixed. We referred him in, stuck him on a waiting list. I never heard from him again. He got his operation done, and there were no problems. The other guy was younger, I think probably, I can't really remember, 30s or 40s or something like that. And he was an experienced builder who'd worked his way up in a big building company, but relatively recently started up his own building company. So it was a startup. Mm. And he was the sole breadwinner for a wife and three young kids. And because the business was relatively new, I think there kind of can be financially a sort of cash flow can be a bit difficult at that time. And he'd got this hernia, kind of lifting heavy stuff, I don't know, bricks, roofing tiles, something like that. And he was worried because it hurt when he lifted stuff. It seemed to be getting bigger, which is what can happen, particularly doing a lot of lifting. Mm. He was then having to employ more people, or I don't know, maybe the same people, but on more hours to fill in for the stuff that he wasn't doing. So there was financial pressure. He wanted this fixed as quick as possible. And this is the NHS, and there were waiting lists. So the waiting list was long. He wanted to be rid of pain. He was stressed. That was undoubtedly influencing pain levels. He needed pain drugs that the other patient didn't need. After the surgery, the pain persisted longer. He was reluctant to get back to normal activities. He was worried about, you know, stressing the wound too much. I think also his hobby was some sort of sport as well. I think it might have been football. And I think a lot of his social contact was through that. So that's how he knew all his mates. He'd stopped playing football. He wasn't getting exercise. That's how he managed his stress. He wasn't seeing his friends. He was in a very difficult situation. And this was a guy with didn't have any kind of mental health history. He'd never been depressed or anxious before. He was a normal guy. And you can see how in this situation we have the same disease but two very different illnesses. And what we're alluding to here, which we'll talk about a lot more in future episodes, I hope, is a biopsychosocial model. Okay, so we've got the biological symptoms, which is the hernia, but the psychological situation is different between the two different patients, and the social situation is different between those two patients.
Got it.
And the interplay between these three nodes, bio, psycho, social, is very, very different. And there are consequently very real changes in that. So I hope that kind of makes sense.
That does. So kind of what you're basically saying is the disease is the kind of, I guess, is the kind of Oh, the illness is the journey, and the disease is maybe not the destination, but it's certainly a kind of waypoint along the destination. So it's like you may have the same kind of point you go past, but the way in which you go past it is very different. And what sort of struck me is, you know, it's that term you hear sometimes, the vicious circles and virtuous circles. You know, it's like the for the virtuous circle, for the first example was, actually it sounded like his life was relatively, he was relatively positive around him. You know, there was income, comfort around his income, generally relaxed kind of sort of sense around him. And he was able to stay in that virtuous circle of, actually, I feel better, I get better, therefore I feel better. Whereas for the second guy, a vicious circle, that pressure to sort of solve this, actually the pressure of income, the kind of been missing out on social life because of this illness, that putting more pressure on getting better quickly, that putting, that creating more psychological pressure on him to do that. Those are the two things. And I think that's really important, that actually we remember this is outside of the individual in many cases. So it's not that individual is, somehow, being weak or demanding of health services. It's actually what being conscious of what opposite. Sits around them.
It's the very opposite. Exactly. So we'll hopefully talk about this in more detail in the future. But what we're talking about is, as mammals, we have a sort of primal threat alarms. Okay, and for a mammal that is an antelope, that primal threat alarm might be regularly activated by the sight of a lion or even an exposed open space. But for a modern human, the ability to earn money, to look after our children, put food on our table, and be respected by and valued by the people around us are, the same. These are the same important things which kept us, alive as primal evolving humans. So, and things that threaten that cause physiological changes in us. They cause changes in our neural processing, which can be temporary, or they can become more automated and fixed. And that's a concept called neuroplasticity, which we'll talk about a bit more later, which is very important in things like chronic pain and functional gut disorders, and also kind of certain hormones as well. So neuroendocrine changes that are very, very real. And rather than features of weakness, these are often, we see it disproportionately affecting people who are very driven, who have very strong senses of a sense of duty and obligation. If this particular character was some sort of lackadaisical guy who didn't feel any strong sense of duty or responsibility to his work, then you might argue that the stresses as a result of not being able to work would not have been as great. Quite the contrary. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. I mean, you said a lot of big words there, many of which I understood, but I think, I think what you were saying was, and as you say, it's probably a big topic that we'll come back to later, but a bit when you talk about neuroplasticity, you're saying is, if you imagine that kind of caveman example of being chased by a lion, that is a temporary change in your kind of levels of anxiety and stress, which is helpful. But actually, where the problem comes when you become fixed in that state of anxiety, where, in the modern world, whatever that lion is for you, whether it's, work pressure, whether it's family life, when that lion is chasing you all the time, and then you become fixed in a way of responding to that, that's when we start to have problems. Is that too simplistic, or?
No, I think you can't. Yes, you got to that. So I think that the distinction is that if an antelope only got chased by a lion once, it would release adrenaline that would make it feel psychologically anxious and physically mobilized to run. But the fact is that antelopes get chased by lions a lot, and consequently, there is a neuroplastic change. That's a bad example, actually, because antelopes aren't as neuroplastic as humans are. And so antelopes are born already frightened of lions. Okay, that's wired into their genetics. But let's say you've got a human, that if whenever we're in a certain situation, something bad or dangerous happens, has to happen repeatedly. Then there is neuroplastic change, which allows us to respond to that situation appropriately. Okay. So,
yes. Okay.
And in fact, it can be if it's a severe or dangerous enough event, then it need only happen once. So an example might be if you have a serious road traffic accident, lots of injuries, time in hospital, you would very commonly find that person, the next time that they get into a car, even if that car is stationary, they will get a whole load of physiological responses that they never had before.
Okay.
And they might even experience things like visual flashbacks and feel highly anxious, and that would constitute something like post-traumatic stress disorder. But even without those formal diagnoses. But for mostly what we're talking about is about, you know, repeated stressful experiences, which then our humans adapt, and the human brain is very adaptive. That's why we're born so in principle and helpless, is because we have the capacity for change and adaption through our lives. Mm. And most of those adaptions are helpful, and some of those adaptions are understandable but can be unhelpful, for example, chronic pain.
Got it. Okay, yeah, that's clear. So I guess sort of stepping back from and seeing the bigger picture here. So that example that you gave of that individual where, you know, it was more problematic, even though the disease was the same, the illness was different. How big is that? How common is it that you have, of those two journeys, you have, you know, one where it is, there are other things going on? What's the sort of size of this issue?
There's quite a few studies being done in the UK and elsewhere in the world, and the numbers have varied a bit. One done locally with me suggested that 30% of new problems brought to general practice, 25 to 30% of new problems brought to general practice, would be primarily functional symptom groups. And also, but there have been other studies which have showed that number could be as high as 50 or 60% in certain settings.
Wow. So that's huge, right? That's like every other person coming through the door, basically, or at least one in three, is kind of, you know, has got one of these disorders where it's a kind of different pathway, it's a different way that they need to be dealt with.
Yeah. And often we wouldn't really be labelled as a disorder if it's because a lot of people, very high functioning people who might have a bad spell with something and get better. So, for example, if you've ever had a headache as a one-off, now if you'd gone to the doctor with that headache, you wouldn't have had an abnormal scan or an abnormal blood result, but you really did have a headache. So that's kind of a functional symptom in that situation. Now, it wouldn't constitute a syndrome or an illness because it's not impacted. You know, it's not if it was there every single day and stopping you do stuff, then it would. But in most situations, it doesn't. And therefore, it doesn't get a label. Most people wouldn't even go to the doctor about it. And then, you know, for example, when I was doing my A levels, I remember a period where at night when I was going to sleep, I start to feel this sort of tightness in my throat, like there was a lump or there was something stuck in it. And I didn't know what it was. And I was starting to get a bit annoyed by it and a bit frustrated and maybe a little bit worried about what was causing it. And then it was right at the height of them. And then they finished a week later. And then I forgot. I never thought about it again until I was working in general practice and I started to see people with this. And this is called globus pharyngeus, which is a pretty common functional disorder. And it's one of those ones which doesn't tend to be particularly disabling. And usually we can make a pretty positive diagnosis of it early and often reassure people and they get better. Now, there are some people who have some other biological factors that contribute to it, like acid reflux, and some of them are a bit more persistent and end up in the ENT clinic, but very tiny minority. And most of the people I see with it are, you know, pretty healthy, functioning people. They wonder what's going on. They come in, they see me, I tell them what it is, and give them a few strategies to settle it down, and they go away again. So lots of this stuff that's an important thing, I guess, is a massive spectrum, right through from very high-functioning people with transient symptoms through to people who are highly disabled by very severe and chronic symptoms. So, common. And other stats suggested, you know, that about half of referrals into secondary care, by that I mean referrals made by a GP into a hospital specialist, about half of those turn out to have, you know, either entirely or a substantial part of the symptomatology is functional or poorly explained by blood results, scans, et cetera, et cetera. So again, that's huge numbers. Okay. And I think, you know, the costs of this, you know, pretty significant. So you're looking at studies, I think, from the late noughties, maybe 2008, something like that. Sainsbury's report looked at maybe something like £3.5 billion spent a year on the NHS on this kind of stuff. And of course, the spend there, and there was another study as well, which came out with a broadly similar number, so it sort of validated it. And I guess this spend is not money well spent, because lots of that money is being spent on tests which don't show anything, medications, and perhaps in some cases even operations for chronic pain that don't help very much. But hopefully, as we go forward, we can spend more money on long consultations that allow people to understand these illnesses and give them strategies for managing them. That's the way I like to think about it.
Well, and that would be my observation of it, is that, you know, prior to talking to you about it, I'd never heard of the term functional illness. I didn't know what it was. And the fact that, you know, it's kind of somewhere between 25 and 50%. And yeah, obviously, it's a grey area to really be sure about it. But that's a large volume of this is going on. But the knowledge isn't necessarily out there. Well, you know, do you have a sense of why that might be, or why we don't know more about this?
I mean, I don't know for certain, but my inclination is some of it goes back to what I talked about medical education to start with. I think our, you know, general population's knowledge about stuff is to some extent influenced by what the doctors that they see tell them. So it's influenced by medical understanding. But I also think that whilst you may have never have heard of the term functional illness, you probably had heard of the term irritable bowel syndrome. And I think that would probably be applicable to most people listening to this. And I think that, you know, and we can, it can list, you know, I could probably list 30 to 50 different syndromes that are functional syndromes from different departments of the hospital. And I guess one of the difficulties is that I prefer the term functional illness, because certainly with the patients with more severe illnesses and enduring illnesses that I spend a lot of time looking after, they will have symptom complexes from different syndromes. And I think it can be very overwhelming for a doctor as well as for a patient to have a long list of different problems. Oh, it's my irritable bowel syndrome this week. Last week it was my functional neurological disorder. The week before that it was my globus pharyngeus and my breathing pattern disorder. Yeah. And I've got all these different illnesses, and that's going to be overwhelming, particularly if they're being approached in a very biomedical way. So when in fact, lots of the drivers for all these things are the same things. Lots of the solutions are the same things. So these are different symptoms of a similar underlying set of drivers, and that can be a very empowering thing to understand, and give you a very pragmatic way forward. And I think the reason we split into all these syndromes again goes back to the traditions of medicine, which are, you know, rooted in hospitals and hospital departments, and again for very good reason that we talked about earlier, about how the value that specialty gives us. And as we've, you know, understood more and more about the workings of the human body in the last sort of 100-150 years, that's led very naturally to a process of specialization, and so the opposite of holistic, I guess, and what we're trying to now recapture is a more holistic approach. And in fact, some of it does hark back to, if you look to the first kind of general physicians of the sort of 1800s, particularly from where the early psychology movement was born, many of those were doctors who had actually a very good holistic understanding of how illness occurred. And they didn't quite make the same artificial distinctions that we started to do kind of from the early 1900s onwards. And they would often look at physical symptoms as being, you know, often very influenced by thinking patterns and situational stuff as well. So, so I think that's probably the best explanation. The language we use for functional disorders has tended to ape the language we've used for pathological or biological or structural illness. Fibromyalgia is a great example. So fibromyalgia means means muscle, and alga means pain. So we've got fibrous muscle pain, fibrous muscle ache, you know, and that sort of describes what it feels like, but tells you nothing about what's actually going on. So if you scan, x-ray, biopsy the fibrous tissue and muscles of a patient with fibromyalgia, you will find that there is nothing different about them to somebody who doesn't have it. There are very real abnormalities going on in that person's body, but those changes are within the central nervous system and also within the neural processing and within the way that the muscles might behave, but that's different. But we've ended up with a very medical sounding, because it's Latin, term for something. But actually, symptoms like fatigue, brain fog, difficulty with concentration, sensitivity to light, these are all core symptoms of fibromyalgia, or central sensitization syndrome would be a better descriptor of it. But they have nothing to do with people's muscles. But we've ended up with a term that's about 100 years old, which is, again, feeds that kind of biomedical kind of thing.
Yes. Yes. So I think kind of what we're saying is actually none of these things come from a bad place, but actually where we are now is as a result of a little bit of over-mystifying, the terminology and making it quite impenetrable for the patient. There's a little bit of taking specialization to the point where we forget to look at the bigger picture of the whole person. And within that, and probably a subset of that, but a really important subset of that, is thinking about, the mind-body division and not looking at those two things as one coherent whole. And hopefully, with this podcast, I think kind of in our own tiny, tiny way, we should try and do all three of those things, is address all three of those things in the way we talk about these things. So, yes, I'm conscious of time, but I think that was a really fascinating kind of first run through of both kind of your background and also kind of where we are today and what those things mean. So I hope, that's been really helpful. Thank you so much for your time, Steve, and I hope that's been useful for the listeners.
Well, thank you, Alex, and that's really beautifully summarised at the end there, I think. So I think that sets us up okay for our next episode. We've talked a lot about theory and principles here, but I think the next step is to really try and hang this on a real person and a real person's experience and their symptoms. And Alex, you've very kindly volunteered to talk us through your experience of having some of these sort of symptoms and how you dealt with that. So are you still okay to do that next time?
Yeah, more than happy to. More than happy to. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's brilliant. And we'll see you next time, Alex.
Yeah, brilliant. See you next time, Steve.